This is our third discussion of God's justice, Measure for Measure, in Egypt and the United States. Here we explore the economic destruction driving the end of slavery, as well as the topic of compensation for slavery in the U.S. and in Egypt. Quote, "Yet if God wills that the civil war continue until all the wealth piled by the bondsmen's 250 years of unrequited toil shall be sunk, it must be said the judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether." End quote. In his second inaugural address, Lincoln began describing God's justice as measure for measure with God's destruction of the accumulated wealth earned through the unrequited toil of slaves. The history of the Civil War documents the depth of destruction as the war passed through different phases. In the first years of the Civil War, much of the destruction was related to the dynamics of war. The war's infrastructure, railroads, and manufacturing plants were routinely targeted and destroyed. The goal was to create a passive and enervated civilian population, although not a demoralized one. To avoid long supply lines, armies and soldiers were told to forage locally for necessities. Foraging armies frequently do not differentiate between property owned by friend or foe. The governor of North Carolina used biblical imagery to denounce the ravages of his own Confederate cavalry. Quote, "If God Almighty had yet in store another plague worse than all the others which he intended to have let loose on the Egyptians in case Pharaoh still hardened his heart, I am sure it must have been a regiment or so of half-armed, half-disciplined Confederate cavalry." End quote. In contrast to the first years of the war, historian Mark Grimsley characterizes the damage in the final 16 months of the Civil War as the hard hand of war. Routine destruction became part of the plan to break the will of the Confederacy. This phase is best represented by Sherman's crushing and fast-moving 285-mile march to the sea from Atlanta to Savannah in late 1864. General Sherman articulated the need for the hard hand. Quote, "They cannot be made to love us, but they can be made to fear us and dread the passage of our troops through their country. We cannot change the hearts of those people in the South, but we can make the war so terrible that they will realize the fact that, however brave and gallant and devoted to their country, still they are mortal and should exhaust all peaceful remedies before they fly to war." End quote. The destructive force of Sherman's army took on added ferocity as it crossed the border into South Carolina, the heart of the Confederacy. South Carolina was the first state to secede. There, the first shots of the war were fired on Fort Sumter. Union soldiers wanted to punish that state for the pain and suffering that resulted from South Carolina's lead. Entire towns were torched, their finer residences pillaged and destroyed. The greatest destruction occurred when one-third of Columbia, the state capital, burned to the ground. One Jewish survivor, Rabbi Henry S. Jacobs, described his experience. Quote, "I will not now recall the horrors of the Sabbath Eve when I and my family were driven forth from our home to a park in the suburbs, where, wrapped in blankets, we passed Friday night and nearly the whole Sabbath. Save a change of two of raiment and my phylacteries, I lost everything in the world, clothing, furniture, books, manuscripts, provisions, even my canonical and prayer shawls." End quote. God's hard hand of plagues ultimately crushed the will of Pharaoh, his advisors, and people. God's warning to Pharaoh before the plagues, locusts, and hail characterized these as unprecedented levels of destruction. This plague was a direct attack on the will of Pharaoh upon his callous heart. Exodus 9, verse 14. "For this time I shall send all my plagues against your heart, and upon your servants and your people, so that you shall know that there is none like me in all the world." The description continues in verse 24. "Very heavy, such as had never been in the entire land of Egypt from the time it became a nation." The devastation impacted every Egyptian man or animal remaining outdoors, as well as the grass of the fields and trees. The plague of hail occurred during the season of barley ripening and flax on its stalk. Later in the growing season, when spelt and wheat were ripening, the locusts came in swarms. Exodus 10, verse 15. that hid all the land from view, and the land was darkened. And they ate up all the grasses of the field and all the fruit of the trees which hail had left, so that nothing green was left of tree or grass of the field in all the land of Egypt. The magnitude of this eighth plague, locust, was similarly unprecedented. Chapter 10, verse 6, such as your fathers and your grandfathers have not seen from the day they came onto the earth until this day. Verse 14, before it there was never a locust swarm like it, and after it there will not be its equal. In summary, the wealth piled high by the slaves' uncompensated toil was sunk by the plagues of war and nature as God's justice, measure for measure, reigned supreme. The Exodus had another economic dimension not present when African Americans were emancipated: compensation for enslavement. This compensation was a fundamental aspect of the Exodus. It was included in the original prophecy to Abraham. Genesis 15, verse 14, I will execute judgment on the nation that ye shall serve, and in the end they shall go free with great wealth. Compensation was so critical to closing the book on the slave experience that the Bible mentions it three times within the story of the Exodus. In their first meeting at the burning bush, God told Moses how the Israelites were to fulfill the prophecy, they will go free with great wealth. Exodus 3, verses 21-22. And I will dispose the Egyptians favorably towards this people, so that when you will not go out empty-handed. Each woman shall ask from her neighbor and the lodger in her house objects of silver and gold and clothing, and you shall put these on your sons and daughters, thus stripping the Egyptians. When God informed Moses about the final plague, he commanded Moses, Exodus 11, verse 2, tell the people to ask, each man from his neighbor and each woman from hers, objects of silver and gold. And lastly, the Bible records that immediately preceding the first leg of their journey, the Israelites requested and received gifts of gold, silver, and clothing. Exodus chapter 12, verses 35 through 37. The Israelites had done Moses' bidding and requested from the Egyptians objects of silver and gold and clothing. And God had disposed the Egyptians favorably towards the people, and they let them have their request. Thus they despoiled the Egyptians. One southern mistress, Mrs. Alston of Chicora Wood, saw a parallel in her experience. Quote, the conduct of Negroes robbing our house, storeroom, meat house, etc., and refusing to restore anything shows that they think it right to steal from us, to spoil us, as the Israelites did the Egyptians. End quote. Evidently, Mrs. Alston missed the point that God's sense of justice demanded that the slaves be compensated for their forced labors. The core of widespread belief in the South and North was that slaves were owed nothing in return for their servitude. Instead, both Great Britain and the U.S. debated the issue of compensation for slavery, but from the slave owner's perspective. They considered compensation of slave owners for their loss of capital as a means of facilitating emancipation. Britain's Slave Compensation Act of 1837 provided £20 million for former owners of slaves in the British Caribbean and Africa. Compensation was linked to Britain's Abolition Act in 1833, that ended slavery but included a transition period of apprenticeships that ended in 1840. The British government issued bonds to cover loans that were provided by Nathan Mayer Rothschild and Moses Montefiore to repay slave owners. Abraham Lincoln also supported compensation legislation. On April 10, 1862, Congress passed and Lincoln signed the following resolution. Resolved that the United States ought to cooperate with any state which may adopt gradual abolishment of slavery, giving to such state pecuniary aid to be used by such state in its discretion to compensate for the inconveniences, public and private, produced by such change of system. In April 1862, an estimated 3,100 slaves in Washington, D.C., were the first to be emancipated. Congress allocated almost $1 million to compensate their owners. Similarly, Lincoln proposed allocating several hundred million dollars to compensate all slave owners for the losses that would accrue once their slaves were freed. Emancipation with compensation was Lincoln's pragmatic proposal for trying to shorten the war. But he submitted no legislation to compensate the slaves themselves for their labor and suffering, nor for the wealth they had helped the South accumulate. During the war, there was some discussion of breaking up large plantations to provide 40 acres and a mule to emancipated slaves. This was not intended as compensation, but rather it was a mechanism to enable former slaves to become economically self-sufficient. This hope was nurtured during the final stages of the Civil War when General Sherman issued Field Order No. 15 on January 16, 1865. The U.S. Army confiscated 485,000 acres of the Sea Islands off the coast of South Carolina and up to 30 miles inland. This land was divided amongst 40,000 blacks freed during the war. The establishment of the Bureau of Refugees, Freedmen, and Abandoned Land on March 3, 1865, reinforced black hopes for some restitution. Lincoln's appointment of the Bureau Commissioner included reference to a maximum of 40 acres of land that would be allocated to every male citizen, whether refugee or freedman, with a 3-year option to purchase the land they worked. However, these plans for distribution of confiscated land were short-lived. On May 29, 1865, after 6 weeks in office, President Andrew Johnson issued the Declaration of Amnesty, a general pardon to all Confederate soldiers, excluding only the leadership. However, the leaders were encouraged to apply for individual pardons, which President Johnson routinely signed. Both the general and individual pardons retroactively nullified all prior confiscation of individual property, except for a limited amount of land that had been sold. Before the end of 1865, General O. Howard, head of the Freedmen's Bureau, traveled to the Sea Islands to deliver the message himself, informing former slaves the short-lived experience of living and working their own fields was over. After the war, de facto economic slavery developed throughout the South as a result of newly passed black codes. These codes essentially compelled a majority of freed slaves to sign contracts, requiring them to work for former slave owners. In contrast, God's plan for closure of the Israelite slave experience involved not only punishment of the enslavers, but also compensation for the Israelites to recover economically from the years lost to slavery. As the Israelites left the Red Sea on a journey to the Promised Land, they had no reason to look back towards Egypt, seeking retribution or compensation. In the first decade after the Civil War, there was optimism regarding continued progress in the black community. Blacks drove the widespread development of Southern public schools, recognizing that a person could not be truly economically and politically free without a basic education. Reconstruction Acts and federal troops under the guidance of President Grant worked to enforce the 13th, 14th, and 15th constitutional amendments and hold the Ku Klux Klan at bay. These actions were supplemented by the requirements that Southern states write and adopt new constitutions guaranteeing the rights of blacks as a prerequisite for readmission to the Union. Unfortunately, by the 1876 national election, progress had halted, regressing instead in both the political and economic spheres. It would take another 100 years before civil rights laws would provide a structure for guaranteeing and enforcing basic human and political rights, and to a lesser extent, economic rights to individuals of all races. It would take an additional 50 years before compensation under the term reparations would even be debated in the House of Representatives. It totally stalled in the Senate, which refused to even entertain debate. In closing, the Seder includes the popular song Dayenu, It Would Have Been Sufficient, with regard to each of 14 actions of God. It begins with God's role in the Exodus and continues through his role in protecting and guiding the Israelite journey to religious, political, and economic freedom. The black community of the United States, on the other hand, have yet to approach the stage of Dayenu, it would have been sufficient on many aspects of political, social, and economic equality. In our life's journey, we are commanded and expected to imitate God, imitatio Dei, by walking in God's ways, v'halachta b'drachav. Perhaps as we sing God's praise in Dayenu, we might recognize two examples of the word Dai, sufficient or enough, that appear in the Torah. Deuteronomy 15, verse 8. Ki pasoach tiftach es yadcha lo, b'aveit tavitenu Dei machsaro asher yechsa lo. Rather, you must open your hand and lend whatever is sufficient to meet the need. In traveling along God's path, we can facilitate healing the wounds and shrinking the scars left by 250 years of slavery and remove the scabs that are the product of 100-plus years of legalized oppression that followed emancipation. Maybe one day we can proudly say we followed in God's ways, v'halachnu b'drachav, and enable a once-enslaved community to declare enough, as it is written in Leviticus 25, verse 26. V'yasigo yodo umotza kedei geulaso. He prospers and acquires enough to redeem himself. In the next recording, I begin again with a quote from Lincoln's second inaugural address as we explore the concept of God's appointed time. I hope you will share your thoughts on these topics with me. I look forward to receiving feedback. My email address is kchelst@wayne.edu. This is Kenneth Chelst wishing you a truly meaningful Seder and Chag Pesach Kosher V'Sameach.